Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do artists interact with one another across media, across cultures, across oceans, and across centuries? An exhibition that opened last weekend at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art shows how 20th century artist Romare Bearden took the best-known stories by the epic Greek poet Homer and interpreted them as paintings and collages through the lens of his own experiences as a Black American transplanted from North Carolina to Harlem as part of the Great Migration. My guest, in turn, is an African-American painter who lives in Fort Worth and who counts Bearden's striking images as a major influence on his own work. Cedric Huckabee's painting, Hidden in Plain Sight, is also currently on display at the Amon Carter Museum, which is hosting the exhibition Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, through August 11th. Cedric, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So Romare Bearden's story is fascinating in part just because he was so inspired by the places he went, the places he lived and called home and traveled to. Can you give us a little bit of background on how he came to be raised mostly in Harlem, but still had sort of a family grounding in the South?
Well, I think Romare, probably like any of us, you know, we take our experience with us. And his experience, the things in Harlem, he's just like anyone else, taking that experience that he had early in life with him as he went to Harlem, a place that seemed to be a lot faster, that where life moved a lot faster. I'm sure Romare had a way of synthesizing all of that together as an artist.
And there are, you know, people will talk about elements of jazz sort of inspiring his work. And is there, do you think, an improvisational quality even to these very sort of carefully and meticulously laid out pieces of work?
I do. If you look at the pieces and in the show and look at Romare's work in general, you'll see, you know, he's very loose in the way that he cuts out pieces. You'll see cut marks that... they don't all the way stick to the shape. They mm-hmm. go into other shapes, and he's just very loose in the way that he goes about collage work.
Did he cut with like an X-Acto knife, or did he use scissors?
Actually, I'm not sure what he used to do it, but I'm just, when you look at the marks, you can still see the cut marks. And so in looking at the way that the marks are made and that some cut marks are in places and in pieces, I would take it that he was using an X-Acto knife, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure.
So he had a remarkable education, first in this country and then overseas at the Sorbonne and all that. And I guess he went to Europe after serving in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty great place to be at the time. Artistically, I would think,
especially for an artist, you know, that education. I think just going to Europe was an education in itself, and just you know, all that was going on around the turn of the century with Picasso and all of the movements. It was just rich territory for an artist, living and breathing and looking and taking in. I'm sure that his whole experience there was an education.
And these works in A Black Odyssey, which is on display, are based on mostly the Odyssey, but also a few works that are sort of based on the Iliad by Homer. And it's so interesting to think about somebody in the mid-70s, late-70s, taking this really ancient work and saying, I'm gonna do something with this.
You know, very interesting. Romare's work. We think about the work, some of his earlier work dealing with jazz music. And this group of works that are there at the Kimball now are after that period where we mostly, many people who know Romare's work, that's what they think about. They think about the jazz music and photo collage. Well, this group of works, it's not photo collage. It's just collage with sheets of paper to make imagery. And he's dealing with another form of art rather than music. He's dealing with literature mm-hmm. and a classical piece of literature. And literally, I think that Romare is becoming a type of bridge between cultures. I think he's making available the Odyssey, maybe to a group of people who initially it would seem a little bit like it wasn't something that they could identify with. Mm-hmm. And he makes it a very identifiable thing.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this because everybody talks about, you know, Homer's work really having universal relevance. Everyone can sort of understand the story of this noble but flawed hero and his search for home. And yet, I think most European Americans who think about that work think, well, it's all white people. And in these works, the figures are black, and it doesn't really change the meaning so much. I mean, the story remains true, and it works.
Yes, and it does. And Romare does an interesting thing where he deals with the Odyssey, but he also takes little bits and pieces of his current. You know, it's like a stew of. Yes, it's the Odyssey, but there's bits and pieces from his life, mm-hmm. from his experience, from seeing things from his perspective, and that just helps to us to be able to look at the Odyssey with new eyes. And after seeing that show and contemplating all of the, you know, what each piece is about, it makes you eager to want to read, you know, the Odyssey.
Yeah. And I understand he was also willing to sort of not improvise the end of things, but there are different takes even on characters that we think we know really well. For example, the Cyclops here is like a more of a pitiful figure, really, than a scary one.
Mm-hmm. And he does that with a number of figures, which makes it so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it so interesting to see someone's interpretation of, you know, a particular figure.
So this show is the works of collage. Are the watercolors there as well on display?
There are watercolors, mm-hmm. The collage work, and I believe some sketches. And they also have a video there. It's about a 15-minute video where you can hear the artist himself talking about the work.
What was the thinking, do you know, behind doing? Because at first I thought, well, maybe the watercolors are like studies for the collage. But he actually conceived of them separately, right? One wasn't necessarily a study for the next.
I'm not sure. Hmm. I'm not sure what the thinking was, but.
Well, have you done anything like that as an artist? You know, where you create a finished work and then you think, I'm not done with this.
Sure. And usually, you know, it's about, for example, a good example in music is if you've ever heard a particular musician do various takes on a song.
Mm-hmm.
So especially with jazz music, a jazz musician can do one take on a song and that's one thing. But maybe on another day do another take on that song. And it's, you know, by doing the different takes, if you will, then you get different versions, you get different expressions of the same thing, which, you know, it's just a way of elaborating on and commenting on a certain subject.
Yeah, it's interesting when you're creating visual art, particularly for you as a painter, because you can do multiple versions, but once you're done with a work, you have to sort of leave it frozen there, right?
Sort of. You know, there's a whole deal with being done, being done with the work,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you will think you're done with something, and then after a while, there's something that bugs you,
yeah.
that you feel like you have to deal with. But so, yeah, I don't know.
So how did you come to Romare Bearden?
Interesting. I've always known about Romare's work since I was a kid in school, hearing about it. But I think I was able to reappreciate or be able to take a second look at his work as I start to learn more about art and the formal side of art.
Mm-hmm.
I started looking at Romare's work formally. For instance, always knowing his work, let's say some of the pieces about jazz music. You see the musicians and various musicians playing music. Initially, when I was younger, I would look at that and you think it's about jazz because it has images of musicians in it. After getting older and studying composition and studying, you know, just all of the formal things in art, the visual elements, the principles of design. Then I start to look at how he composes the pieces, start to look at how he uses rhythm in his pieces and what he's doing with color and how he's dealing with space and all of those things. And then you can sort of, or for me, I feel like I can kind of hear those pieces. So I gained a deeper appreciation for his work in college after learning those things.
It's interesting that you say rhythm, because that's not a term that people often apply to visual works. Can you talk about what you mean there?
Yeah, so rhythm, color, line, space, even texture. All of those things have to do with visual arts, but they also have to do with music. So in visual arts, there's things that rhyme. One thing repeating what another thing is doing. So there might be a shape, and if something repeats that shape, and you find a number of things repeating that shape, then it's forming a type of rhythm. And, you know, space, you have depth, depth of field, but you also have literal space, one space beside another, like two-dimensional space. And so, you know, all of those things, space, rhyme, there's rhythms created, there's repetition that's happening. And all of that has the ability to give the piece a sense of movement, a sense of motion, and also allows the picture to have an analogy to music.
Mm-hmm. I like thinking about that because it also reminds me of listening to a piece of recorded music, right? You get a new download or whatever, and you can hear a piece of music and like it the first time, but you need to sometimes listen to it dozens of times before
Exactly.
you fully understand it. And so often, as much as we enjoy the art we see, we feel in you know, public settings like we have to look and move on because there's somebody coming up behind us.
Exactly. I think that's where it's good we have this show. We can talk about this kind of thing because you're exactly right. Pieces of art, especially, you know, for example, music, it happens in time. And so you sit and listen to it for a certain period of time. Now, the thing you have the benefit of with a piece of recorded music is that you can go back and listen to it again and again versus if you were at a concert. You could, you know, it was there, you had to hear it, and you had to catch everything while it was happening. But with a work of art, the advantage that we have is that you can take your time, or you can come back to it again and again and look at it in different ways, with different thoughts in mind, and be able to really examine it, you know. And I find that artists like Romare Beard, who they put a lot in their work. There is the conceptual side of it, which, you know, you can look at and think about all of the concepts that the artist is thinking about, and you can think about the picture, you know, all of the content in the work. But you can also look at the piece and be able to hear it and appreciate its aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And you can look at how Romare was dealing with composition and be able to see the relationship between a Romare and an old masterwork, and how maybe he was borrowing from the old masters while at the same time integrating jazz music or the kind of rhyme and rhythm that's in jazz music. So that's a very important thing.
We're speaking this hour with artist Cedric Huckabee. His painting, Hidden in Plain Sight, is on display at the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, which is hosting the exhibition Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, through August 11th at the Amon Carter. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back.
funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is artist Cedric Huckabee. His painting, Hidden in Plain Sight, is on display at the Amon Carter in Fort Worth. And the exhibition, Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, is at the Amon Carter through August 11th. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Cedric, your life and Romare Bearden's life overlap by like a dozen years. You were not, you know, sort of on the planet at the same time, but you're separated by generations. Mm-hmm. Nothing like the separation between Homer and Bearden. But I mm-hmm. wonder if you still feel like it, like some of your work that you feel is inspired by him is a sort of dialogue across generations.
I do feel like that for a number of reasons. Romare's work with collage, the bits and pieces, putting them together, and I work a lot with quilts. Mm-hmm. And it also is a matter of bits and pieces and putting them together. But not only that, he worked with much of his work had to do with African-American aesthetic, where he was, you know, using the music as an influence and the culture in general as an influence. And I think in that way, you know, there's a dialogue, too. Romare is one of the few African-American artist who at times was dealing with the entire family. Hmm. I found that in a lot, you know, many artists, they were dealing with sections of the culture. They were, some deal with the African-American male, and they'll deal with the African-American body and such. But there was some of Romare's work that just did deal with the community and the family. And that's I'm big on those two points.
Well, talk about your fascination with quilts, which are such a remarkable art form, in part because they are an art form, but they're also inherently this utilitarian object. And you can it raises for me questions about why we need beauty in a thing that is functional and yet will work really hard to have something in our lives that is beautiful.
The quilts. I started originally painting quilts. My grandmother was a quilter. Mm-hmm. And some of the quilts that I paint, we used to actually sleep in. So we grew up with those quilts on the beds. And at a certain point, I thought to use them in the paintings as backdrops to still lifes. And along the way, there was like small discoveries, one small discovery at a time. And at a certain point, I thought the quilt is enough of a subject itself. It has enough richness in just what it is and what its claims are that I don't need the still life in front of it. Hmm. It's going to be the still life. And so after making that transition, I started focusing in on a quilt, and I realized that you can use a quilt to talk about all of the issues of life. You can talk. It talks about family. It talks about just basically you can use it to talk about anything.
Do you actually use, do you work with textiles yourself? Do you make quilts yourself?
I don't make quilts. Mm-hmm. Now, my grandmother was a quilter, and actually my wife makes quilts, mm-hmm. contemporary quilts. She's an artist also. She told me to give her a shout out.
Fair enough.
She's an artist also, and mm-hmm. she actually makes contemporary quilts using, she prints out on fabrics and does stuff like that. But no, I don't actually make quilts. I paint images of quilts.
So when you're painting them, how do you go with a magnifying glass, and do you want to sort of know every stitch before you start, or is it do you start with like an essence of what you want to portray on the canvas? How does that work for you?
There's different ways of approaching painting a quilt, but usually, you know, you have the quilts, and sometimes I'll have an idea about, like, and many of the ideas I'll get just from looking at the quilts. For example, the idea being what this painting is going to be about other than just the fibers in this particular quilt. So, for example, one of my pictures was called When Old People Talk to Young People. And so there were two quilts in the image. There was a quilt by my grandmother and a quilt by my wife. And it had to do with the whole legacy of quilt making and the legacy of a people handing down, you know, traditions and things to a younger generation. And so that was the idea. That was, you know, the concept that I had. But as far as painting it, I would hang them on a wall in a way in which I felt like the quilts spoke to each other and spoke to the subject. And then, you know, just get close enough where I can, the quilt is in plain sight, very visible, and I'll go from there.
Can we go back to something you said before about, you know, making the transition from having the quilts as a backdrop to a still life to recognizing that these really ought to be the focus of at least some of your works? What did that feel like? Was it like you went to bed one night and then you woke up the next morning and slapped yourself and thought, I can't believe I haven't seen this? Or was it a gradual transition?
It was gradual, but there was also an aha moment. At Yale, I took a class by Robert Fierce Thompson. It's called the Black Atlantic Visual Tradition. And in that class, we studied a lot of the aesthetics that crossed over into other cultures that came from Africa. And in looking at those aesthetics and in studying them in the music, and we studied them in dance, and then we got to the visual arts, and I'm looking, and then the light bulb goes on. Hey, you know, this is the same aesthetic we've been using. It's the same thing we've been doing, and everything that's discussed there, this is what we've been seeing and doing and living all these years, and it's the same aesthetic she had that she put this quilt together with, the high-effect color, the improvisational way in which they put together the patchwork on the quilts. They didn't, you know, all of the things that we were talking about, the lights just went off. Listen, the quilt has enough in it to be the subject of a painting without putting stuff in front of it.
Did you think of your grandmother as an artist when you were a kid, or did you think of her as, you know, grandma who happens to make these beautiful quilts?
Yeah, I didn't think of her as an artist as a kid. But we always appreciated, you know, things like those quilts. And literally that older generation, they were a generation that worked with their hands. I think it's a thing that as we go forward in time, less and less you have people who are just sort of makers and do things. But so we were always appreciative, but I didn't think of her in my mind as an artist until later. As I start to evolve as an artist, then I start to look back and think, you know, she was an artist.
Is she still with you?
No, she's not.
Did you have a chance to talk to her about sort of recognizing that she was an artist?
No, I didn't. So I have, you know, in talking to one of my aunts, I've talked to her about the experience of making quilts with my grandmother and about how, you know, they would sort of give the quilts names and different things like that. And they did it as a group. And I've often...
So they like, sort of decide together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've often compared the quilt making to the African-American woman's jazz music. Just because at a certain period of time when there were very few African-American women playing music, they had the same aesthetic in the visual arts that they had in the music. But it went along, for instance, a number of men might, you know, get together and play music and using these sort of aesthetics. Well, there was, during that time, women were getting together and they were using the same aesthetics, but they were making quilts.
So the same collaborative process and the sort of call and response almost with what you're doing on this side of the room and what you're doing over here. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you remember any of the names of the quilts?
I don't.
Were they named for people, do you know, or like
seasonal names and different types of names that just would have to do with them. But I never remembered a name that had to do with a person.
So you always name your paintings, right?
I do.
Yeah. Is that a scary process, or is it something that seems so obvious to you from the time you start what something will be called?
Names come about in different ways. Sometimes they come at the beginning, and sometimes they come during the process. But it dawned on me one day that they can be, if you allow them to be, an important thing. It's kind of like that old question, is a rose still a rose if called by any other name?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, with works of art, it can make a difference. The name could make a difference. It doesn't have to. It's not going to change any mark of the painting. It's not going to change any color that you've put. But it will change maybe the way through just the intellectual aspect of the words or the name. It might change a little bit the way I see something.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think definitely for the audience, there's a suggestion of maybe what you were thinking or where we're supposed to go with something.
Exactly.
Well, tell us about Hidden in Plain Sight.
Hidden in Plain Sight is a large work, and it's based on the idea that African Americans used to hide messages or encoded messages in quilts along the path of the Underground Railroad that would lead the slaves, obviously, to freedom. And so there's been a lot of debate about that. Did they really do this? Are these symbols, are they really encoded messages or were they not? There's been, there's back and forth on whether that actually happened. But I looked and thought about the subject and I thought, you know, whether they did it or if they didn't really do it, wouldn't that be an interesting thing to do?
Yeah.
Be able to encode messages in quilts and for people to be able to look up and perhaps with enough time and understanding decode the message.
So the idea was it would be like hanging out to dry on a line or mm-hmm. something and people would be going along.
Yes.
Yeah. Does this work contain an image of you as well?
An image of me?
It's just the quilt?
Yes, it is. It's four quilts and it's four panels. Mm-hmm. One quilt per panel. And they collectively make up one larger image. And the image is there's the four quilts, but you also see sort of a suggested circle and a suggested cross.
It seems like when people who are not artists, well, I'm just going to speak for myself here. When I'm working on a project sometimes, there are moments when I'm really enjoying it and moments when I just want to get it done. And I always imagine that artists are sort of in this constant state of bliss and that you never get to that place where you just want it done and you want to move on. But I wonder if that's the case or if there are times when the work, if not this work specifically, but it gets frustrating or you think, where am I going with this?
Yeah, you know, there is. You go through a lot of changes while making a work of art. Literally, sometimes you start with an idea and you end with something very different than the ideas you had. And so the same way the work goes through changes, you also go through changes. You know, sometimes I might be very excited to get started on something, but that's just the beginning. Somewhere in the middle, you know, there's places in which the work is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's and that's what it is in that part of a lot of work. But with me, a big thing is, and I would say this is probably with Romier and a number of artists, which is the whole idea of improvisation. Some people can do that broadly, and some people can do that on a micro level. And that's an important part in my work, or important thought, or an important concept, because it keeps you lively and active in the work. And so, for example, let's say I have a painting. I know what I want to paint. I have the quilt. It's on the wall. You know, you know what you want to paint, and you kind of have composed it. But the area of improvisation comes in at the very moment of how you're going to make this thing. How literally are you going to paint it? There's a I guess there's multiple ways in which you can interpret a piece. I could, you know, use some kind of pointillist technique in interpreting the piece. I could use very thin paint with glazes, or I could use a thick impasto, which I really like, and stir the paint around and see, you know, different points of interest and different ways of making it. And that's very important to me, because that's where, you know, I can kind of stay alive in the interpretation of the work. And so I think everything happens in the work. There's moments in which it does become work, but there's also very lively moments. And the idea is to keep it lively, to try to keep it lively as long as possible.
Do you go hunting around in, like, antique stores and you know, people's yard sales and things like that to find pieces that you might want to paint or to be inspired by them?
Not really. There was a point where in a show in 2008 on Big Mama's House, I was looking for some old wood that reminded me of the old wood of her house, mm-hmm. that was around of her house. So I went around to find some wood that would remind me of that. But in general, just walking around to find old pieces, even in, there are pieces that I've done that are sort of a little more raw in their creation and where they use literally old wood in the pieces, mm-hmm. but I never have to look far to find it.
My guest is artist Cedric Huckabee. His painting, Hidden in Plain Sight, is on display at the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, which has the exhibition Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, on display through August 11th. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, which we'll resume in just a couple of minutes, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is artist Cedric Huckabee. His painting, Hidden in Plain Sight, is on display at the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, which is hosting the exhibition Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, through August 11th at the Amon Carter. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So how did this work that your painting is being featured at the same time? Did they call you and say, pick your favorite work? Did they call you and say, we want this set of panels?
The Hidden in Plain Sight, I've been working on the piece for quite a while, and I've even shown it in fragments and even, you know, as an entire piece. But when the museum curators came over, when they saw that piece, they knew that would be the piece that could show well in that space. And you know, if you get the chance to see it, it really fits quite nicely in the atrium space that they have there. So
And how does it relate? Is the exhibition in the same sort of area that the Bearden exhibition? So will people definitely see your work sort of on the way in or on the way out of seeing the Bearden work?
Sure. It's both of those, mm-hmm. because you have to pass the atrium to on your way to the Bearden work, and you literally pass the atrium, you go upstairs, a set of stairs, mm-hmm. and the Bearden work is upstairs in those galleries. So you pass the piece in the atrium on the way to the Bearden show.
See, I always love that when a gallery or a museum has sort of curated things so that you can have a sense of how different kinds of work relate to one another, because it does sort of elevate, it makes it for me, it generates new questions about both sets of work.
Mm-hmm. And I think they took that kind of thing into consideration. They literally have three generations of African-American artists showing at the same time. I know that they took that into consideration in putting things together.
We've talked in this show on other occasions about the need to, or the desire that many people have to really cultivate. People would love to have 1,000 of you living in North Texas, you know, living and working and creating works. And people talk about it needs to be organic or should there be programs. What do you think it takes to, like, have artists choose to work in a Fort Worth or a Dallas as opposed to, you know, running off to New York?
Well, what the tendency is, artists, they'll make their homes, make their studios in places, first of all, where they can afford to live, mm-hmm. and work. In places like New York, you know, New York obviously it's built up a reputation over the years. But as time goes on, it becomes a bit expensive for an outsider, a person,
yeah.
who didn't grow up in New York, to go there and make their stake. So I think artists have always had the ability to adapt and to, if they can find a space where they can make a living and have time to make work, they adapt to different spaces. And really, they've always had the ability to transform or be a part of the either the cultural awakening of a certain area or a certain movement in the arts in that area. Artists are always a big part of awakening the culture. And so maybe that sort of helps.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you appreciate sort of municipal efforts. Do you think that works? Can cities, build enough space or lofts or whatever, or is it really not about that? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, are really targeted efforts to bring artists in, are those not organic enough? Are they too artificial?
It's good that people, city planners, et cetera, are thinking about artists,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about ways that we draw and thinking about ways to accommodate artists or to encourage artists to stay around. So I think that those efforts are definitely good. Much of art, it's more than just, the planning in the city. It has to be cultivated, and that starts at the level of education and educating some of the, students about art, encouraging art through the schools. And then as those young artists grow older, then providing a space and the ability for them to be able to create their work. A lot of it has to do with the economic situation. Providing a way economically for artists to be able to do what they do. But when people are thinking about that and they're trying to find ways of attracting artists to the city, trying to find ways to accommodate artists, all of that would be a big help, I'm sure, to any artists who are out there and considering, should I stay here or should I go to some other place, where the artist is going to be thinking, where can I go where I can make my work? And, and be appreciated. And if that's here, if you make certain accommodations where the artist can make the work here and be appreciated here, then, that's where the person is going to want to stay and live.
Has teaching changed the way that you communicate with, well, I guess your students are art students, but has it changed the way you communicate about works that move you or that interest you?
It makes me communicate about them.
Uh-huh. As opposed to sort of staying in your own head.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And learn how to articulate, you know, what you're thinking, your thoughts to other people. Because generally, you know, many artists, we have learned how to, and in general, part of the reason some people are can become an artist, sorts, is because you don't articulate verbally.
Mm-hmm.
You found ways of articulating visually and expressing yourself through visual means or and using that as an outlet and even a way of speaking. So, but teaching challenges you to not only try to verbalize things more, but also get out of yourself a little bit and look at other artists and look at the way other people create it and just sort of lose yourself and think about the art and aspirations of others.
That's really interesting because it has occurred to me that some visual artists in particular are great observers of the world around them in the way that mm-hmm. a lot of novelists are. And so therefore, they are sort of inside their own heads and watching things. And did you have to learn to balance all the energy it takes to communicate about what you're thinking about works and to teach and all that with the energy it takes to sit back and observe and just sort of watch the world go by and process that in such a way that it manifests itself in work?
That's a big part of being an artist, right? That whole thing. There are literally two different mindsets you're talking about. One of them is a kind of verbal understanding of things, and then another one is a nonverbal understanding of things, where you sit and you watch and you look and you experience and that whole thing. And so having to balance that. You know, being able to verbalize and talk about something, which really, in some ways, allows you to understand it in a, I guess, in the context of this conversation, in a verbal way.
Mm-hmm.
You can really own something and literally talk about it. But there are other ways of understanding, and so that is the life and the walk of every artist, which is experiencing things, understanding things, but then also having to have a kind of mindset where you process those things and be able to talk about them, articulate them, and literally deal with other people with those ideas in a verbal way.
Yeah, that raises some interesting questions about the role for not just art scholarship, but like art criticism, you
mm-hmm.
know, because it almost, the way you're describing it, it almost sounds like you are translating, you know, from French into Spanish or something. These two things that are, maybe two things that are even more different than that, but you're taking two different kinds of communication languages and having to turn one into the other.
Sort of. I mean, it is like that. To a degree, and I believe that with all art, it's somewhat like that. When we think about a dance, for example, or we think about a song, or we think about any form of art, there's the act of translation. There's, you know, the art can be, you know, a midnight summer. Or whatever it is, there's a translation that has to happen,
mm-hmm.
and it's those two sides, and they have to talk, they have to converse, and really, you're right. In art criticism, it's so very important that the critic is not just a verbal person.
Hmm.
It's not just a person who has learned how to talk about art.
How to describe what they're seeing only.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the person could, it's one thing to be able to just talk about art. And, you know, you go on about it, the history of it and everything else. It's another thing to understand how to make something.
Hmm.
And that in the process of making something, what happens with eye-hand coordination? And when we go off the road with something where we're being guided by our intuition, how do you talk about intuition, you know? So it's very important that critics understand art from both a verbal place and understanding the history, the context in which it was made and all of that, but then also just literally look at a painting, understand how it was made, the physical process of making something, and that whole side of making a work of art.
So obviously you need an idea and you need good lighting and you need your media. But are there conditions you like to have in the studio when you go in to paint? Do you listen to a certain kind of music, or what do you do to sort of prepare the space you work in?
So I do a lot of different types of work. Some work is in the studio. Some work is not in the studio. There's a group of paintings, a group of drawings that I started working on last summer, about the 99%, where I would walk around my neighborhood and draw people. There are some works that I've done over my grandmother's house, where I literally had to take all my paints and stuff over there, and I was painting her and the family and different people. And then there are the works that I do in the studio. And so that's a lot of different types of experience experiences making art. Literally, it's a very different experience to paint a person and to paint a quilt. One is sort of a still life that you're listening to and you're looking at. The other is, a person looking at you, breathing, sitting in front of you, and they have a limited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's two very different experiences. So I have a lot of different types of experiences in my art making practice. Sometimes there's music. I'll play music, sometimes not. Sometimes there's literally talking to the person if I'm painting from a person, sometimes not. Sometimes it's quiet. So there's just different approaches, and I don't just have a system in place, although there's been all types of approaches from listening to music to listening to the radio. Sometimes I listen to you.
Do you, when you go back and look at a finished work, do you remember the hours and hours and hours that went into it and sort of what you were thinking at the time? Or do you then just look at the finished product?
I think I just look at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I just look at what it is and what it's about, hoping that it has in it everything that all of the intentions that I had for it, that it meets all of those intentions and expectations.
Did it take a while for you to sort of unlatch from relentless self-criticism?
I don't know if you can unlatch from that.
Right. Cedric Huckabee has a work on display at the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth through August 11th. That is also the timeline for the exhibition Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey. You can find more information about that online. We also have links off the Think page. Cedric, thank you so much for being with us. I so appreciate it.
Me too. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.